Hello and welcome to another episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. In this show, I speak to Mary Johnson of Watershed Resource Consultants and one of the co-founders of TerraGenesis International. With a background in plant and soil sciences, Mary has spent the last several years working with conservation organizations in South America, Latin America, and Mexico to work on mitigating the impacts of climate change on local populations by aiding communities to gain access to funds and help return resources to their home region. My desire to speak with Mary arose from my conversation with Rico Zook on practicing permaculture internationally. Her experience is very different from someone who would teach around the world and lend a different perspective. We discuss that and how to get involved. However, a large part of our conversation is about climate change and the need to build human relationships through communication. Mary's travels have allowed her to see firsthand the disruptions that are occurring because of climate change. In a world where we can control our environment with the push of a button and choose what to eat based on what's at the supermarket or a local restaurant, these problems are not always self-evident, but they're coming. To understand that and make the changes necessary to solve these problems, we need to care for the people involved and communicate clearly from their perspective and their experiences to bridge the gap between ourselves as individuals and build relationships with communities. However, our conversation is not without hope. The roots of permaculture are bifurcated between the indigenous knowledge of the past and the growing understanding afforded by science, brought into a synergistic, holistic system that values the world, people, and all life. Permaculture provides ways to find and implement solutions for the changing world. Thankfully, there are governments and organizations that are beginning to see that we have a way. I hope you enjoy this time with Mary Johnson as much as I did. On with the interview. So Mary, why don't you go ahead and begin? Let us know a little bit about what your work's been lately, and we can take it from there.
Sure, great. Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity and the work that you're doing. It's really great. I guess most recently, I've been working probably for the last 4 or 5 years now with a number of different conservation organizations on mitigating climate change through the processes that were started with the Kyoto Protocol, primarily working at protecting standing forests in tropical countries. There's a whole lot that goes on with the discussions about whether that's the right way to go about things or not, and who's causing the problem and who's actually doing the work to try to stop it and all of that. But at the end of the day, that's the work that I was involved in. And a lot of what I got to do in the positions that I had was going out, working with community leaders or members in particularly in Latin America, South America, Central America, and Mexico, trying to find ways that they could leverage this process to gain access to funds from the minority world countries that have a lot of the wealth, to try and put in place systems that would incentivize people to protect their forest. Nobody necessarily wants to see their forests destroyed, but in a lot of places, people don't have any choice. They're trying to feed their children, or they're trying to deal with climate change that's already affecting them, be it that their Amazon River is not flooding the way it used to, and fish populations are being affected by unnatural freeze conditions that have never been seen before, or whether it's up higher in the Andes and glacial spring meltwaters are not as abundant as they used to be because the glaciers have receded higher up, farther away from where people are living. So my background is a lot in field science. So a lot of the work I was doing was going out with people, teaching them how to measure the biomass in their forest, because that's part of what needed to be done at the beginning of the process to see if they could make a measurable change by changing practices that were happening either with agriculture or forestry or illegal logging, land use change for other reasons, migration, things like that. So that involved going out with some local staff members, often of these conservation organization partners, small NGOs that work in country near those forests, training their staff and volunteers how to measure trees, how to use biometric equations and things like that to estimate how much carbon exists in the forest. And then pairing that up with remote sensing data was captured through satellites or through light airplanes to measure the change in time of the forest cover. And by doing those two things and linking them together, you can get an estimate of how much that forest is changing over time as a result of clearing lands for agricultural expansion or new roads or dams, things like that.
Mentioning field science gets my science geek pinging a little, even though my background has not been science for some time. Are the equations for measuring the carbon in the forest, is that something that's fairly accessible, or would someone need to go through some specialized training in order to get there? Like, is there a resource that you could point to for someone if they'd like to learn how to do that, or even be able to just do a walkthrough of an area and find that information?
Yeah, there's quite a bit that's been published in the last 15 years. One of the organizations that I was working for, WinRock International, has a number of manuals that are available online, as well as PowerPoint presentations that explain step by step how to do that process and how they go out and work with different communities to measure that. And a lot of times, those equations, some of them are sort of averages for different forest types, but frequently those actually have to be created through the measuring of those trees. So people actually have to go out and research which species are in an area and how much biomass and what the growth curve is for those types of trees and that sort of thing. But a lot of that data is now available for a good number of forests because this has been such an important global conversation for a while.
Okay. And that would vary then if you have something like an older East Coast forest that's going to be more established oaks and things versus like what we have in Pennsylvania now because of the logging and cutting where now the majority of our forests are more maple than the long established hardwood. So you would have different information depending on what you would find in an area.
Yeah. And a lot of the equations might be similar if you were talking about Northeast forests in general.
Okay.
But those forests would be very different from forests in the Congo, for example.
Okay.
And so you would use different equations based on the type of cover that's there, the type of habitat and ecosystem. So those forests would grow differently. That's the main reason why a lot of the red projects reduce emissions from deforestation degradation happen in the tropics, because they grow so much faster than Northeast forests, for example, that there's more carbon being stored there more quickly. And so it's a lot cheaper to do a project there, reducing emissions, than to do a project here, trying to change industrial carbon emitters, for example.
Okay. And now, is my understanding correct then that a lot of the carbon in a tropical area is going into the trees because it's not going into the soil like it might necessarily in the Northeast of the United States? Because of the...
I'm not sure if the wording of that is exactly scientifically correct. The reality is that in tropical forests, the carbon is primarily in the trees.
Okay.
Because of the humidity and the temperature, it just doesn't stay in the soil very long. Whereas in the north, it can stay here in the soil for a while.
Okay.
But the process, I think, is pretty similar. The trees drop their leaves, and that's carbon, and it just gets consumed and turned back into tree matter more quickly in the tropics.
Okay. Yeah, my understanding of that process was a little different then. Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah.
So how are you using that information then from these equations in the field research to leverage change with those individuals and in their communities?
A lot of that really comes down to just dollars and cents, like most places in the world. The more carbon that an area can protect, the more they can potentially sell that to a buyer that wants to invest in carbon credits. And a lot of this process over the past few years has been really speculative. Carbon market and prices, especially for red projects, has been pretty volatile, and it's gone up and down. And a lot of that's depended on what kind of progress has been made at the international conventions on climate change. So when the price was high, there were lots of people who were really excited to try and invest a lot of money. And, that often draws unscrupulous investors and unscrupulous project developers. So working with these NGOs, one of the benefits of doing that was that there were scientists working in these communities for the long term, often working with indigenous groups to protect their wildlife and protect their territorial rights and work on land claims and things like that. So they had a face in the community already, and that gave them a little bit more sense of trust to work with these groups. Whereas there might be somebody who just walks in off the street who could be a scam artist in a lot of ways, saying they're going to get these folks a whole lot of money and all they have to do is sign this paper, and who knows what will actually happen. So there's a lot of stories of that have gone down in some of the places that I've worked as well. So
So building those trust relationships between the scientists and the organizers on the ground with the local communities is important in order so that you can build the proper relationships to actually take care of the land and those people so that then they can trust you in return that the work that's being done is legitimate and that anything that they get out of that is going to be for the work that they're doing.
Right. And some of those processes also evolved along the way, trying to get informed and prior consent from groups, making sure that that's part of the national process for RED is something that's developed because of these bad situations that have happened, trying to make sure that contracts are written in a way that actually allows people to still maintain control over certain aspects of their forest that they really need to maintain nutritional lifestyles. Same with, you know, farming rights or just making sure that the project is actually developed in a way alongside the community members so they have a voice in describing what they want their future to be and what ways these project funds could be used to actually help their communities rather than being fed into a specific project. It's really complicated stuff. It takes a really long time to do it well. And I think that's a lot of the reasons that it hasn't really grasped hold and gone forward rapidly. There's science behind it, but most of the process is really quite political and requires a lot of communication across groups that don't necessarily see the world in the same way. With a commodity that's traded on public, you know, markets fluctuating. So it's not necessarily the best system, but it's what was the best that people could pull together from all around the world.
This is a system that right now everyone can agree on and work within that framework until something better can be developed. So you're stuck with both the advantages and the limitations of the system at this time.
So. Yeah, it's not everyone agrees on it. There's still tons of controversy and for good reasons. I think things are shifting now from what I've seen recently in the news away from this process of mitigating climate change and more into trying to put money into developing economies that are based on low emissions. So sort of more of a transition of entire energy systems rather than trying to, after the fact, it absorb carbon that's been emitted by high emission development, which it makes sense to me that that might be a better approach, but this is in its infancy still, so we'll see where it goes.
But by moving to valuing low emission systems, then you move those dollar and cents away from the high emitters to the low, and then that provides more capital to those organizations to make even further change rather than just trying to mitigate.
Yeah, I don't know all of what's being discussed at this point, but I think it's more of looking at countries that are rapidly developing around the world right now that might go into a high emission trajectory, looking at developing coal or other natural resources that exist below ground right now and trying to get them to, instead of going down that route, adopt cleaner emissions technologies and putting money into doing that. That's my sense, but it's not my expertise. Yeah.
Okay. This is certainly a much bigger picture project process than I run into regularly. So it's a lot to try to comprehend between one of my guests recently and I were discussing science and that, you know, if your car breaks down, then you go to a mechanic. But if you are worried about climate change and you get the numbers from scientists, then people make it turns into a political issue.
Right.
And bridging that gap where the scientists can be trusted and then actual public policy can be made around that information rather than just throwing it away because it's not seen as fiscally feasible right now for whatever reason or whatever the roadblocks are to actually move the process forward rather than resist it all the time.
Yeah, and then on the other side of that also is once the political process goes through trying to reapply it to the real world, which I think is even the tougher job. Frequently those discussions happen with people who have had extensive education, perhaps speak one or two languages like English or French, and have never lived in the countries where these things are being applied or the communities where the education options aren't available. to even understand what's being discussed. And then those are the communities that need to have time to be educated in all of these matters before they can even discuss whether they want to get into a contract and do this with their land. So a lot of people don't realize just how much of a disparity there is in knowledge between the parties that need to come together and develop these kind of agreements. And it's, you know, can really impact people's lives tremendously, particularly the lives of women. And even in the conservation organizations that I worked with, that understanding was very low still. The gender analysis portion of things is kind of lagged behind, and people are just starting to realize that a lot of these RED projects weren't necessarily designed looking at what kinds of impacts these changes would have on the lives of women, who are often the least involved in the process and the least able to kind of withstand major changes on the household level to the amount of access they have to natural resources or how far they have to walk to get firewood to be able to feed their children and things like that. So it's all very complicated. So that's, for me, where permaculture has kind of entered my heart. You know, doing this climate change work at first is a bit disheartening, especially kind of seeing some of the changes that are already happening and the communities are really being impacted by this change. In permaculture, Ethan Roland was one of the people that sort of showed me some applications on a larger scale, and it really like just made the light bulb go on for me that this was a possible, really helpful solution in a lot of these places, that at the individual level, people could transition and survive these really rapid and unexpected changes in their local environment by being more resilient in the home scale as well as the community scale with permaculture.
Is that where you've been applying permaculture then, in that personal and community level with your work?
I do a little bit of that, and I also try to bring that perspective in on the larger scale, working on projects that may be dealing with national level governments trying to develop these bigger policy agendas for their RED process and the national strategy for RED and things like that. So I do a little bit of both. I have some independent consulting work that I do with Terragenesis International and through my own company, Watershed Resource Consultants. So at that level, I teach permaculture to individuals, and I also work on sort of home scale or farm scale planning projects and design projects. And I teach with Holistic Management International a beginning women farmers training program.
Okay.
And so aspects of permaculture design come into that work that I do. But then I also, with these other larger conservation organizations that are dealing with, you know, maybe $5 million projects or $20 million projects that are happening over 4 or 5 years in one country, for example, when the groups that are designing those projects are having their meetings trying to lay out what the work plan is going to be and what the goals or deliverables should be, these thoughts and these design processes are always in the back of my head, and they come out when we're working together. You know, if somebody's, you know, got this great idea, but they haven't included the gender aspect, or they haven't realized that they need to take climate variability into account before they go ahead and use this money, that's where my voice kind of comes to the table and brings that perspective out.
And when you're doing this, I've talked with some folks, and some of our conversations are that a lot of times it's easiest to sell permaculture by not calling it permaculture and just using those ideas to inform the information and the decisions that you're helping to make. Do you ever bring out permaculture directly and go, hey guys, this is the idea, let's talk about this? Or are you just using the framework of permaculture to inform the way that you're having the conversation?
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that. It's very interesting. Working with U.S. government, there's kind of, you know, a very strange dissonance, I guess, in between one hand and the other of the government. In the national scale government, like the Natural Resources Conservation Service, for example, I wouldn't use the word permaculture. It's, you know, it's so conservative. They're wonderful people who work for that organization, but for some reason, permaculture is just seen as this kind of fringe out there thing. And yet, if you go and work internationally, USAID itself has brochures about permaculture and promotes it and puts funding into it with farmers that are working in dry land areas or that, you know, have rainfed agriculture and things like that. So it really depends on the group. I just use whatever I can to try and get the concepts across to people. I'm not opposed to talking about it. I think different parts of the world have had different experiences with it. I enjoy working with groups on permaculture internationally, sometimes more just my personality than I do with groups in the U.S. who are often kind of students who are curious about it, not so much people who are really farming and trying to survive and feed their families from their gardens. So.
There's still that, you know, if it gets too hot, they can walk in and turn the air conditioning up or...
Exactly. If they don't feel like eating that day, they can go down to, you know, Chili's and not order a hamburger or whatever.
Yeah. Well, because you have a background in soil science, if I remember right, from looking at your bio.
That's right. Yeah, plant and soil science.
Yeah. And I know some folks who I talk to, some of the resistance with permaculture is because it's not as rigorous to get involved with, and that I can't, in many cases, there aren't large scale, double blind research studies to point to say, well, this is why this works, this is how this works. And that's where some of the resistance that I've encountered comes in. Because mm-hmm. I can't hold permaculture up against agronomy or biology or any of the other sciences that have been standardized over generations. And because of that lack of rigor, it's discounted or dismissed sometimes.
Right. I think that's sort of a chronic failing of our culture in the minority world, is that rationalist viewpoint that you have to break things down into their simplest parts and study them in scientific method and get an answer. But the real world you can't study it that way and get the same type of information because it's too complex. There's too many changing variables. You can't get that information. So, there is some, definitely some sense that you can't feed the world without commercial monoculture systems. But I think that is going to be tested as the climate changes, because those systems are also extremely vulnerable to these rapid or random changes that are starting to be experienced on large scale. And so those farms that have all of their capital invested in one crop, in one system, no soil cover, no soil structure left, you know, they're going to have the highest risks as well to being wiped out by some of these events. Whereas these smaller, more resilient systems that are mimicking the diversity that has survived millennium on the planet will be the ones that will be left standing. And then I think the conversation will start to change a bit.
Well, just today I was reading an article because, you know, we're here on the East Coast and the heat is coming through the United States right now and this ongoing drought. And it was a federal government official, I forget with what department, was saying that they're out surveying fields right now and there's nothing. That it's just acres and acres of crops that have been wiped out because of this. The lack of access to water, the excessive ongoing heat, and already forecasting what those impacts are going to be on the U.S. food supply.
And it destabilizes political systems worldwide. I was working in Haiti on a project proposal right around the times of the food riots happened 3 or 4 years back. And it was the same sort of thing. You know, one part of the world experiences a big shock like that, and then commodity traders just get involved and prices are totally unstable of staple foods that people need to survive, and they don't have the flexibility in their income to be able to withstand those prices. So there's so many things that are linked together that the whole world is going to be feeling these shocks when this stuff starts to happen. And, you know, I'm not a doomsdayer or one of those folks that thinks of things as a big conspiracy or whatever. You know, my passion about climate change and working on these issues comes from really working with some of the top scientists in the world who are really examining the day-to-day effects of these changes in precipitation and temperature over time. And, you know, when I start talking about this with people, if they're on one of the sides where they just want to argue about what's causing climate change, I just say, you know, it doesn't really matter what's causing it. It's happening. We can measure it. We can see the trends. And people who have no education whatsoever see the trends and are saying, what's happening? This has never happened in the history of our oral tradition, you know? So things are really serious. And most people in the United States have no idea. Climate change sort of dropped off the radar as far as public discourse because that polarization happened, where one political group was saying, no, it's a farce, it doesn't exist, scientists don't know what they're talking about. And the other folks are saying, no, no, it really exists, and it's caused by X, Y, or Z. And, you know, people worried about the impacts on the economy. But other folks in the rest of the world who really depend on their natural resources for their daily survival take it much more seriously. And for good reason, you know, the latest projections of what is going to happen as far as average temperature rises around the world, they're extremely devastating. You know, the average person thinks, well, like a little 3-degree change in temperature, that's no big deal. But what they don't understand is that that's an average and it's in Celsius. And there are places in the world where it may be 15 degrees. And that means that, you know, the entire ecosystem will crash if that happens. And this isn't in 100 years. This may happen in the next 10, 20, 30 years. You know, we'll see huge levels of extinction of different species, and we don't know which ones yet. And we don't know what those impacts will have on other species, including ourselves, and all of these political boundaries that are somewhat invisible right now, water rights and food and commodity prices and all of these things. We're such a globalized economy now. Same thing with infectious diseases. I was working last year with the Wildlife Conservation Society, and that was the first time that I kind of got to see the link between climate change and diseases that transfer between livestock and wildlife. And that just kind of blew my mind as well, just seeing that these vectors, these insects and viruses and things, they are also changing with climate. And most people have no idea what that means, but it's going to mean a lot of things that we haven't had to deal with before as a human society. So it's interesting. Things are going to be changing rapidly. Whether folks want to, you know, do the research and read up and find out what might be happening in their part of the world or not is going to be up to them, but things are going to be happening for sure. It's going to be an interesting period in history.
Whether you want to be aware of it or not, the change is here, and there's going to be more coming.
That's right.
Yeah. And there are quite a few conversations going on here in where I am in central Pennsylvania about a lot of the storms that we've been getting, and tornadoes and thunderstorms, because those are the weather effects that we get here very often, and how that temperature increase, that average also changes the maximum and minimum temperatures as well, and the differences between storm fronts, so that also causes more devastating storms. And it's a lot to try to take in as someone who's just only has so much knowledge about science, and then how do we have that conversation to make it meaningful when, again, you can just go, oh, well, I can still pay for gas, I can still afford my electricity bill, I'll go in and I'll change the AC, turn the heat up, and not have to interact with that.
Right. And the other thing is, you know, the scientists aren't able to really give people a sure answer because some of this is so new, it's hard to even know how the Earth is going to react. You know, this year's droughts out in the Midwest and the fact that there's absolutely nothing growing, that itself is going to trigger a whole bunch of changes that we don't know the effects of yet. It's a whole bunch of soil that's dark colored if you look at it from space. The reflectance will be different. The heat patterns will be different. That will trigger storms in a different way. The amount of soil that will wash away or blow away as a result of that drought, enter into the Gulf of Mexico, that, you know, through the Mississippi River, that will have impacts on storms and on weather. All kinds of things are happening at a scale that it's just not possible for scientists to study it quickly enough to get a sure answer that politicians want to be able to say, okay, that means we should put a certain amount of money into this problem, or that means we should support this policy. So it's unfortunate that that's how we work as a society, because it means we can't be very adaptive or proactive sometimes. Sometimes, you know, we're the aircraft carrier that's only going to make that turn after everything's already, you know, been really so devastated it's not going to matter once we get there. But I don't like to take that view because, you know, I have a daughter, I'm a young person still myself. I like to try to at least think that, you know, when the time comes, human beings will reach out and help each other, and we will find ways to support each other, and hopefully, you know, rather than fighting for precious, scarce resources, we will rise to the challenge and find ways to regenerate and share resources that are scarce and come up with new systems that will work to help people survive.
With some of the work that you've done with the NGOs in South America, Latin America, and elsewhere, have you gotten to see some of that with the communities that you've worked with?
There's definitely a lot of great people doing really wonderful work out there, and I've been really lucky to be able to meet them. And super inspiring. I mean, Haiti actually was one of the most inspiring places that I got to work, and that was before the earthquake. You know, I arrived there and just looked at the landscape and was so blown away by the enormity of the problem. You know, I felt deflated. And I was there, you know, writing a proposal for, I think it was a $150 million watershed restoration project. And that $150 million, as soon as I got off the plane and I saw those mountains with nothing on them, I was just like, this isn't even going to be a drop in the bucket. But after I spent some time talking with professionals who were Haitian, who had spent their whole life working on these problems, I was absolutely amazed at how much hope they had and how many great solutions they had and all the wonderful projects they had been working on. So, you know, it's amazing what the human spirit can do, even despite, you know, sort of the worst conditions that you can find. And there's a lot of great people out there who do have a lot of great knowledge from trying to solve these problems for years of their lives.
And all we need to do is continue to carry that forward through the next generation and the generation after that and solve some of these issues.
Yeah, and I think one of the things, like your podcast program, that's changing is that we are creating these new modes of exchanging information and empowering each other. That's another thing that I really love about permaculture is, you know, the fact that you don't have to go and get a PhD to be able to talk about it. You can learn a little bit. You can start working on it. You can go out and get other people interested and they can start learning, and you're making a difference right away. And it feels good. It draws people in. It looks beautiful. It just builds that passion and that fire in people's spirit where they can be empowered and talk and get other people involved. And that can catch, you know, it's very compelling to other people. So there's a lot of hope in that for me, that with the internet and with different forms of media that are available now that never were before, these kinds of messages that bring hope to people who really need it, you know, can change the world really quickly. So hopefully there'll be a permaculture revolution starting now.
Well, when you talked about gender analysis earlier and now with technology, one of the next large markets for technology right now where the discussion is going is mobile, because of the billions of cell phones that are in people's hands worldwide. And with some of the micro-lending that's occurring and being able then for communities to go pull some money, have a cell phone in the community, and in many cases they're smartphones, from what I've been seeing, because of cellular bandwidth is a lot easier to deploy than it is over landlines. And it's one of the things that has me hopeful is that something like the online programs that some of the other permaculture instructors are developing, that we might be able to find a mobile format to do that. And then if we can do that with the proper distribution method, it can be in billions of hands very quickly.
There are great projects working on that. I'm a huge fan of a lot of the social entrepreneur ventures that are happening and things that young people are doing with cell phones. And it's such a great medium for this because people can get things and watch it on video or hear it. They can hear it in their own language, in their own voices. So barriers that used to exist where maybe one person who got to get educated and learn English and leave their community might be able to bring that back and try to teach a few other people, you know, those don't exist anymore. Instantly, you know, whoever can get access to a cell phone or get a project to get that access can transform things. I mean, there's some danger to that as well, you know, cultural shifting and all kinds of other things happening that we don't, you know, it's going so fast we can't stop. But hopefully the good will outweigh the bad in that level, and empowering people who did not have access to information in the past is really an amazing thing.
And we have a way to communicate in many ways that are outside the purviews of government or other organizations that may try to stop that flow of information, which is always interesting to me.
Definitely. It's really important. It's really important in a lot of these countries where I've been working, because the political discourse is really, it really affects people's lives, and people are afraid to even talk about certain things. You know, it's hard to imagine that growing up in the U.S. When you go someplace, you talk to folks that are working with you on a professional level, and you have to hear them say, you know, I can't talk about that because, you know, I never realized that that was such an important issue in people's lives still in places in Latin America until recently.
Is it strange sometimes as an American to travel to these places culturally and having to find where the lines are that you can work within?
It's a huge, huge process that you don't even realize how difficult it is when you're in the middle of it. You just get surprised by things. You know, one example is I was working with some local people in the Andes, and they were hired on as base staff to help us with the biological survey. And, you know, we were using GPSs to, you know, mark certain transits that we were doing and to capture some of the data. And, you know, I trained this person who became a great friend of mine to, you know, put the data points in and use the GPS and walk around and take the points. But it was like after a week of doing this work that we actually sort of started talking about what we were really doing and how it was working, that we came to the point where we realized that he didn't know that satellites existed. He'd never heard of them, didn't know what they were. And so, you know, all of this was really outside of his understanding, and it was outside of my understanding that he wouldn't know that. And it was just lack of experience on my part in the area and with this particular group of people. But it's that kind of stuff where people just have such different backgrounds that they don't even know what they don't know. And it takes a long time to get the conversation to the point where you're like, oh my God, I have no idea how we're communicating because we're not speaking the same language. We're not understanding each other's upbringing or background or education or anything. You know, it's a beautiful process. I love it, but it is really mind opening.
With some of the work that I've done locally, there are issues with race and gender. And some of the folks I've worked with have been very clear about that and upfront about it, just that, you know, there are some places where you can go and talk with people where you'll be welcome. There are places where I can go and talk with people and I'll be welcome, but never shall the two meet in some ways. Have you encountered that being an American and a woman with some of the cultures that you've dealt with, or have the organizations that you've interacted with helped kind of smooth that over?
Oh, no. I honestly, that is, you don't even have to leave the U.S. for that to be a major issue. I am not a person to keep my mouth shut sometimes when I see things that are happening that aren't really, in my mind, just, or that aren't understanding these gaps that exist that need to be addressed, especially when public funding is being used. And it's been really difficult for me in every context that I've worked in the U.S., in the scientific community, in the higher education community, you name it. Gender and race issues are the big undiscussed elephant in the room at every possible sitting. So to me, it's something that I really wish that more people would sort of let down their guard. Everybody's so angst-filled about discussing it. If people would just, you know, take a big, deep breath and say, you know, we're all in this together and we'd all be better off if we worked on this a bit. Because it's, again, it's complicated and it's filled with personal hurts and it's filled with a lot of historic pain, and it's very difficult to talk about, and a lot of people have no skills whatsoever in even understanding other people's perspective or what they go through on a daily basis. So it's huge, and it really needs to be dealt with, in my opinion, and I hope that it gets there.
Something else to add to our list of challenges to overcome.
Yeah, definitely.
Whenever I look through this lately, both within my personal and professional life, a lot of the conversations have revolved around the power of communication and the need for it, and the way that we can both identify with ourselves and others as individuals, and then also properly communicate our needs with others so that they can be met. Do you ever get into those kinds of conversations about, like, okay, let's step back, and because we need to define a baseline that we're going to work from in order to carry?
I've been surprised, you know, having spent so many years working just from sort of a science perspective or an agricultural extension perspective, that lately what I've been realizing is sort of the crux of most problems is really kind of at the individual level, the psychology, and that basic issue of communication and of valuing people and of people's self-esteem and sort of getting over the hurts that they've experienced in their life. Reevaluation counseling is something that I've just discovered through permaculture. Again, that's one of the things that I love about permaculture, is it's not just about plants, it's not just about climate, it's about everything. It's about all of us getting all of these needs, overlapping needs, to work and function. Especially when I've been working in other countries lately where mental health systems are really unavailable to the majority of people who are really living in dire conditions, who have a lot of hurt all the time, and they can barely ever escape it. That to me is something that's never even discussed in any of these types of organizations that I work with, these big multi-million dollar projects, like how the individual people are doing, you know, what they're struggling with, what they've been through, whether it's war or famine or, you know, huge mudslides and storms and things, like addressing the community shock from these events and how families can cope with loss or how they can cope with fear, insecurity, the skills that they need, and gender violence, child abuse, sexual abuse, all of these things. You know, that's the reality. When you actually go and you live in these communities for a while, you become friends with people that are there, really close knit with families, become part of their families, you start to realize that's a lot of really what's going on the day-to-day basis for people. It's that human aspect of things. And, you know, these projects that develop in these great conservation organizations or any kind of organization, it's so dictated by these really limited parameters, and that those kinds of things are really far outside of the expertise or comfort zone of people who are getting the money to do these projects oftentimes. But if it's not dealt with, the projects will fail because they're not really addressing the core needs of the people. And those people sometimes don't know how to express that they need those kind of services because it doesn't exist in their world. You know, it's important stuff. It's complicated. And I can't say that I'm even the least bit educated to discuss it even. You know, certainly every culture has its way of coping with problems, healers and traditions that work for them. But I have seen a lot of people recently with a lot of trauma that don't have anybody really talk to or healthy way to deal with it.
And though we look at earth care as the first ethic of permaculture, in order to make the choices that we need to in order for that to happen, then we need to care for ourselves and each other to be functional enough to make those changes.
And to support each other, to follow through and to share resources. I think that the way that permaculture was conceived, including those ethics, is really clever because, you know, there aren't very many systems out there. You know, you were talking before about the folks that want to see double-blind studies to prove that this system actually is going to produce more potatoes than planting them alone with mountains of chemicals, herbicides and things like that. You know, this is just so completely different world of looking at things that it's hard to even communicate about it because they're just not talking about anything even remotely similar, you know. But the ethical behavior behind permaculture is something that it's beautiful and it's important and it's really worth having conversations about.
The more that people have these conversations, the more that this information gets out there, the more that we can continue to grow and move permaculture away just from a land design system to a more holistic, well, an even more holistic approach to handling people and the way that we all fit together in this system.
Okay. Yeah, and one of the things that I also been sort of noticing recently, just doing some other reading, A great book that I just enjoyed is called Cosmic Serpent. Part of what is described in permaculture really draws from traditional ways of life. And it's just written in a way that Westerners and Australians and Europeans can kind of fit into our worldview. But, there are certainly many traditions that have existed for thousands of years using this type of a way of being, where culture interacts with ritual, interacts with planting and natural cycles and mimics nature and includes nature worship and includes family, all these things. So I often talk to my students and say, this isn't necessarily something that Bill Mollison came up with out of the blue. It works because it's sort of the natural way that human beings have found to survive and that other animals also use to survive. It's not just human beings that work in this way, and ways of knowing and using plants, how we learn things. It's all fairly mysterious, and there are lots of great ways to describe how we can do that and how we can gain knowledge. It's not just going to the university and picking up a designer's manual or going to a permaculture course.
So even with your background in science, you find the approach to permaculture to be equally as valid, to take the broad picture and apply it and use these different traditions to inform your current place in the world?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, science is really limited in its applicability in a lot of ways. And, it has great uses, and it's been used in ways that have allowed humans to do tremendous and amazing things, so it's important. But as far as a way of living, it really doesn't even begin to answer most of the questions that are important for our survival,
Because this moves beyond necessarily the physical to the cultural and the social and the spiritual.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Things that can't be studied with a minimalist process, a rational process, things that are cyclical and cyclical and measurable in eons rather than in discrete, lifetime studies. Time scales, just our brains aren't quite meant to know all of those things. The mystery is equally as important as some of these answers.
We've covered a broad range of topics this evening.
Yeah.
So rather than keep you much longer, I will ask, if someone wanted to get involved and do the kind of work that you're doing with non-governmental organizations, around the world, like how did you get started, or how would you recommend someone gets their feet in and start walking down that road?
Yeah, that's a good question. I get that a lot if I teach, especially college students or people in transition. Well, what's worked for me frequently is, doing my homework and becoming knowledgeable in the area that I want to work in by, reading and studying on the internet and researching organizations. And then, really assessing what I have to offer, what I can bring to the table, and making sure that I actually have something that's useful to other people and that they might want to pay me to do. So that's a big first step. And then after that, often volunteering for a while so that people can get to know you and trust that you're going to work hard and be responsible, and you do have something to offer them, has really worked well for me, to actually finding paid positions. It's tricky. It's a very small world. So once you do get in, you often run into the same people in different circles over and over again, even if you might be on opposite sides of the world than you met them at the first time around. And literally, I worked for WinRock and had phone conversations for a year with someone who was working, I think, out of Indonesia. And then 2 years later, I showed up at a job in New York City for the Wildlife Conservation Society, and I hear this voice on the other side of the cubicle, and I'm like, that's awfully familiar. And it was the guy that I'd been working with, a project on RED in Indonesia, who hadn't happened to have his life revolve around the world and ended up in the same office on the opposite side at the same time. So that kind of thing happens a lot.
A guest who I spoke to before talked about that they had done some self-funding in the beginning. Did you have to do any of that, or were you fortunate enough to just kind of key in and be able to go?
I guess, you know, if you're able to volunteer, that's sort of self-funding. Not many people who come from working class backgrounds or poor background can really even afford to volunteer their time. So that can be difficult. One of the ways around that is to use your college loans to get real experience and get internships so that you are paying yourself with those college loans to get the kind of footing you need in the door. It can be tricky at first. It takes years. I mean, I wanted to work internationally, you know, since I was, you know, a teenager. I knew that, and I had to work for probably 15 years in the environmental field here in Massachusetts, doing things I didn't particularly like, but because I had to pay back school loans and I needed experience before I found the opportunity to start working internationally. And knowing another language is really critical too. You really can't do that work if you only speak one language.
Is there anything else that you would like to share with the listeners before I thank you for your time?
I guess the biggest thing I like to tell people is to not be afraid to just get started. You don't have to take a permaculture course. You can just get on YouTube, and some of the greatest teachers out there have a whole lot of wonderful videos that you could watch for hours and learn some really amazing stuff. And then just, you know, get involved in your local community garden, start a project, join projects. All over the world, there are meetups about permaculture. Whenever I travel now, the first thing I do is, you know, search Permaculture Peru, and voila, there comes a name, a phone number, an address, and I go and I visit and I meet some of the most amazing people by doing that. I've done it in Paraguay, and I've done it in Ecuador and Colombia and Panama, you know, and just you really get a great community when you make that, you know, you extend that hand and find people that are always very willing to talk to people and share what they're doing. And there's lots going on all over the world. So that's my advice.
Thank you for it.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk. It was really nice.
Thank you for joining me for another interview. If you have comments or questions about this or any other episode, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com and leave a message or send me an email. That address is show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Until the next time, take care of yourself, the earth, and each other.